Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein on this Thursday before the Memorial Day holiday. In the second half of today's show, Dave Thompson and I will review this week's news, and Matt O'Lean stops by. He and I talk about The Idea of You. It's a movie starring Anne Hathaway. But first, I'm here with my co-host, Ashley Thornburg. Ashley, we're coming up on Memorial Day.
Yes, a time when we remember fallen soldiers and lost loved ones. And that can mean we are driving a long ways to visit graveyards, or we're getting together with those who are still in our lives. And as we head out into those long drives over this long weekend, we look at what makes this area unique. One example, the Métis culture. The Métis come from a blending of Indigenous and European ancestry, most often French, Scottish, and English. Their homelands are in southern Canada and the northern United States, including right here in North Dakota. One of the most notable cultural contributions is their music. In 2022, our former intern Nick Rommel traveled to Turtle Mountain to see Métis fiddlers in action.
Driving through northern North Dakota, I can see for miles through my bug-splattered windshield, all the canola fields, the windmills, and the very occasional towns under a bright blue sky. But the landscape starts to change as I approach the Turtle Mountain Reservation. The small clumps of trees grow in size until a forest of aspen and ash rolls up and down with the area's namesake plateau. Small lakes, ponds, and marshes dot the depressions in the landscape, and suddenly there are houses every 200 yards. Locals say that around 15,000 people live on the reservation, though the census drastically undercounts them at about 7,000. The landscape feels boreal, northern, and not as predictable, and I feel like I've entered a totally different environment. Well, it is a different environment, and it's populated by a little-known North Dakota ethnic group, the Métis. I had come to Turtle Mountain because I wanted to meet Joe Parisian, a local musician that plays electric guitar as well as the traditional Métis fiddle. He's proud of being Métis, and he explains to me what exactly that means.
For those that don't know, the word Métis is or Métis, they pronounce it at times. It's a French word that means mixed. And the people here of this area, here in Turtle Mountains of North Dakota, really, were all of mixed blood origin. When the first Métis came into existence is when fur trapper or a fur trader, someone connected up with a Cree lady. And they had their first offspring. So that was the beginning of the Métis. The Frenchmen, they seemed to really cling to the Cree ladies for some reason. I heard stories because they were like good-looking people, they said. And I don't know if the Frenchmen had good taste or not.
The mixing of French and Cree happened mostly in the 18th century. And today, the Métis inhabit primarily what was considered Western Canada back then, the provinces of Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta. It was here that they worked as fur trappers and buffalo hunters. And when the Canadian Hudson's Bay Company acquired a monopoly over the fur trade in 1821, uncompetitive fur prices led many to start working as oxcart drivers. They would haul their goods through North Dakota and up the Red River towards St. Paul and the American fur market. The Métis practiced a kind of frontier Catholicism, and most are Catholic today. They have a unique language too, Michif. It has a lot of regional variations, but the way Joe described it was Cree verbs, French pronouns, and nouns. His example phrase,
Péta mou crayon,
includes the Cree word for bring, Péta, and the Canadian-accented French for my pencil, mou crayon. Turtle Mountain's Métis heritage may not be immediately clear. The tribe is called the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians, using an anglicized term for the Ojibwe Nation. Ojibwe, not Michif, is taught at the tribal college. The history on this gets pretty murky, but most sources agree that both the Métis and the Ojibwe inhabited North Dakota, Minnesota, and Ontario. But Turtle Mountain was overwhelmingly Métis until Thomas Littleshell brought his band of Ojibwe to the area around 1880. The leader was looking for new land as white settlers encroached upon Minnesota. It gets even more complicated here, but basically the federal government cheated Little Shell's band out of a ton of land, kept doing it, and then ended up giving them a small 6x12-mile reservation. The reservation was calculated to be big enough for just Little Shell's Ojibwe people, disregarding the larger Métis population that still lived there. This partially explains Turtle Mountain's unusually high population density even today. But back then, it meant overcrowding and starvation, especially as the local fur trade and buffalo population faded away. People turned to small-scale farming and gardening, hunting, and selling forest products, and many found work with government agencies during the 1930s New Deal, or started traveling for seasonal work. Joe Parisian was born into this time, and listening to his stories, the woods around us kind of come to life with the echoes of what used to be.
Yeah, the conditions were much different than they are today. You know, I mean, like there was no electricity in those days, so we heated our home with a wood stove, cooked with a wood stove, you know, and then in the real cold time of the year, in the evenings, my dad would burn coal. You know, we'd burn coal keep heat going all night, because I remember sometimes waking up or whatever, and it got so cold in the house, like things would freeze at night. You know, we didn't have refrigeration in the day, so after the weather got cold and stuff, they'd butcher the hogs. Then they kept them in place, it's a shed or whatever. They used to call it, in Mitchif, it's a French word, le hangar. It's like a hangar. Mm-hmm. During the summer months, we ate like a lot of wild duck or wild game, you know, and chickens, you know, we raised chickens, and then, kind of butcher our own chickens up there, you know. And
Joe is grateful for all the comforts that his home has now, but remembers his family traditions warmly and fondly.
A lot of our customs and traditions kind of revolved around our Catholic faith and our Catholic teachings. And
just imagine it, winter in Turtle Mountain. Snow piled high between the leafless trees. The wind is whistling, the sky is overcast, and the little coal stove in the Parisian's log cabin is huffing and puffing, working to keep the bitter cold out of those two rooms.
After Christmas, you know, then they'd really start getting prepared for New Year's, because it was a big Métis or Mitchif celebration. You know, all the families that did that. And it would start on New Year's Eve, and then it would go up till All King's Day. I think now today they call it Epiphany Sunday, you know. All the homes, I mean, people travel from home to home. They'd go eat their customary foods there, like the Liboulette, Li Bain, it's a fried bread, and a lot of other foods, you know, that they'd cook, and they'd serve for all that time from New Year's to All King's Day. There was a custom in our home, and it was in a lot of other homes, that you be at your parents' home before midnight on New Year's Eve. I mean, whatever they were doing, if they were out someplace or at their home, they had to make their way to the parents' home, you know. And if you didn't do it, it was kind of almost somewhat of a sign of being disrespectful. Like my mom and dad were the oldest ones that we had there, and of course my grandma was still living too, but like at our home, there's 18 in our family, 10 boys and 8 girls. They'd bring their kids, and boom, they'd come, and then my dad would give them a blessing. He'd give all the kids, starting from the oldest one to the youngest one, a blessing, you know, individually, yeah, you know, and wish them well.
And then there was the music. Joe's dad, John Parisian, was a prominent local fiddle player, and Joe told me that their cabin was a nerve center of music and dancing on Turtle Mountain. This song is called The Country Waltz, and Joe learned it from his dad before the elder Parisian died during Joe's 11th year. to play with this computerized background now, which he takes with him to gigs. But the dances that went into the night at the Parisian household must have sounded kind of like this.
My dad was his fiddler. He was an excellent fiddler. My mom played the piano, and we had all the other singing and dancing in our family. So our home was always kind of a, I like to call it like a nerve center, you know. A lot of them bush parties went on in our homes, you know. Kind of had our own little Nashville act in our home, you know.
Bush party or bush dance is a local term from what I can tell.
Well, there was like really not many places to play, like halls or anything like that. So a lot of the bush dances that they call them, but they'd really gather in the homes. Then they would push things aside, and then they'd start their square dances and waltzing.
After waltzing, they would transition to other types of tunes. Métis fiddling is divided into different categories that have to do with speed, rhythm, dance steps, and fiddle technique. Craig Lunday is another Turtle Mountain fiddler, and he explains some of these differences to me when I meet him at his home, perched on a hill overlooking the woods below. Hornpipes are fast, but also sweet and melodious. Breakdowns up the ante a bit, mixing speed with the kind of repetition that makes you want to dance feverishly and intensely. And jigs are distinguished by the rhythmic dance that accompanies them.
You know, your feet are going, it's... And it's the same time you're playing your fiddle.
The Red River Jig is an example of this kind of tune, and many call it the Métis National Anthem because of how popular and symbolic it is. Jig, by the way, doesn't refer to the Irish dance, but to a French dance called the Gigue. And then there's the technique of discording, where one or two strings on the fiddle are retuned, so that you can hit them with your bow even while playing the melody on another string.
Making the other strings harmonize with the string that you're actually playing. It'll drone out another string to make it vibrate and give it more sound as you're playing that particular tune. And you can kind of hear the drone a little bit when you...
Craig is of a younger generation than Joe, and picked up the fiddle at the local Turtle Mountain Community College. He needed one more credit to graduate, and on a whim, took a fiddling class taught by a local musician.
As soon as I got into the class, I was hooked. I got addicted with playing, and I constantly played night and day.
Sometimes it was hard to transpose this traditional music into a classroom setting.
And you try to get an instructor that's a Métis fiddler to slow down the tunes. His version of slow down was... And it wasn't slow for me. It's like I recorded it and I was trying to learn only by ear.
Craig kept learning tunes by ear, slowly figuring them out on the fiddle. Most traditional music is passed down this way, and musicians end up putting their own spin on these tunes as they learn them. Craig did that on Big John McNeil, this tune from earlier.
Because the way most of them play is... And I don't. The way I play it is...
So Craig played on, sometimes going extraordinary lengths to perfect his fiddling.
I was in college at the time. This is when I first started learning to play. And my wife was... She's a nurse, and... Well, her shift would be 12-hour shifts. I would have my children and at home. So my thing was practice, you know, and the most I think I've ever played that I kept track of it was 9.5 hours in one day. I would be zoned into trying to learn these tunes, and I would be putting pressure down on my chin rest, and just out of the blue, we were traveling somewhere, and my neck started hurting, and it got really bad, and I didn't know what was going on, so we went straight to the ER, and then they couldn't figure out why, and I didn't have a clue of why it was. Here, finally, I told them, I said, well, I play fiddle, and I'm constantly putting my chin down on the chin rest. So the doctor figured it out that it was from me practicing every day and putting pressure down on the left side 2-3 hours a day. It was starting to pull my neck over, so I had to go through physical therapy at that time.
Our conversation continues, and eventually Craig goes to a back room and pulls out his great-grandfather's fiddle, made in Paris in the 1840s.
It's Vieux-Méant Paris, so yeah, it is a French-made fiddle.
Craig's great-grandpa, Pat Baker, was a prominent local fiddler as well, around the same time as John Parisian. At this point, Craig's dad, Alvin, chimes in with his boyhood memories of Mushum Baker, as they called him, using the Michif word for grandfather.
We had a big house down, it's called Gordon Lake, on the east side of Gordon Lake down here. And it's, he would play in the living room, and I would sit, I had a little stool, I'd sit alongside of him. I still remember that. But yeah, he would play for bush dances. I was able to sit up for a while until we got kicked to bed, so we had to go to bed. I would listen to him.
And it's no less than a small miracle, but Craig was able to learn a tune his grandpa wrote and played decades earlier. Someone had recorded Pat Baker in the 1950s on tape, and the recording had migrated to cassette and CD over the years. When Craig started playing fiddle, his great-aunt asked him to learn the tune, which they named Mushum Baker's Waltz. Alvin joins in on guitar, father and son playing together. That's not even the only song rescued from the decomposition of time in Turtle Mountain. Joe Parisian has a similar story about a song of his father's, except rather than digging the tune out of an old box of cassettes, it came back to him from the depths of his own mind.
Okay, I'm going to do a tune here now that my dad composed. This was before he passed, like we said, 1957. Then I started just playing it here a few years back, you know. But I remembered it. It's kind of strange after all these years how you can still remember how things go, you know. And I called my older brother Jim and asked him if this is the way that my dad's tune was. And he said, you're playing it just like him, you know. But I hadn't played that in years and never really practiced it or anything. I'd never had a name for it.
He called it John's Breakdown.
In fact, I was just kind of thinking about that when I was playing that, how in the day when my dad was playing his tune, just trying to visualize the people dancing to that, you know, because they really weave in and out pretty rapidly, you know.
We've talked a lot about remembering in this piece, but memory's a funny thing. You can tend to it like a fire and pass it down, burning bright and strong. Joe and Craig certainly do. In fact, both of them told me they'd like to record the reservation's remaining Michif speakers and use the recordings to create a language curriculum for the local school system. But you can also let the fire of memory burn out, raking the coals into the dirt. Soon night falls and the woods go dark. The coals stop glowing. Mixed in with the dirt around them, they're just charred fragments of the fire they once belonged to. But it doesn't mean they're not there. I pull my car off the pitch-black road and into the island of electric light around a small bar. Squeezed between two pickup trucks, I shut my engine off. In the silence, I can make out Joe singing and guitar playing from inside the bar. He's playing a gig that he's invited me to. I walk across the dirt lot and step inside.
Baby, say I don't need to disappear. The boundaries are
down. It's comfortably warm, and the lamps cast a cheerful glow over the bar area. The bartender rehashes some inside joke with a customer, while clumps of revelers stand around them, laughing and hollering. In the next room, the old fiddler is playing a Keith Urban song on electric guitar, while couples swing along to the tune in each other's arms. The more reclusive ones are in the back, cigarettes aglow in the blue mood lighting. I buy a ginger ale and find an open spot by the wall to stand in. People curiously ask me where I'm from, and one elderly lady tells me to stop standing like a statue and dance. I laugh, and I seriously consider it, but then a tall man in a camo ball cap sidles up to me and asks if I know Joe. I explain my connection. He nods slowly and asks if I know why Joe is playing here tonight. What do you mean? I ask. He just lost his better half, the man says, a little bit of beer on his breath. Oh, yeah, I respond. In fact, it was the first thing Joe and I talked about after I came in his front door. Joe's wife of 50 years died suddenly of COVID this past winter, and he spoke with such fondness about her, with such heartbreak about her passing, that I admit I welled up within just 10 minutes of being at his home. I look back at him now, that musical lifer, crooning country songs on the little stage. The tall man in the ball cap nods deeply and somberly, then turns back to me to speak. And he said he'd never play again. But there he is, wrapping up the song as the dancers turn and applaud. Joe looks over at me, and with a wink and a nod says, "This next one goes out to my man Nick." I laugh, and he launches into Merle Haggard's Working Man Blues, upbeat and bouncy.
It's a big job getting by with nine kids and a wife.
It was a song we had played together at his house after the fiddling was done. The tall man in the ball cap goes off to find his dancing partner while I finish my ginger ale. When the song ends, I take my leave, waving to Joe. He smiles back with his eyes and gives me one more nod.
I drink a little beer that evening and sing a little bit of his Working Man Blues.
The cool air hits me as I step back into the night, and the sounds all mix into one as I drive off through the dark of Turtle Mountain.
Listening to Prairie Public right now, so I bet you're a bit of a news junkie, right? But do you also like music? Well, I bet you do. Prairie Public is the place for that too. Did you know that we have a guy named Mike Olson who spends adult album alternative music during the week?
And there goes the last DJ who plays what he wants to play.
He's got an endless library, limitless musical knowledge, and a clever way of handcrafting sets of songs. You can listen to Prairie Public's Roots Rock and Jazz stream on an app or a smart speaker pretty much anywhere, and on an HD radio anywhere in the region. Check out Mike Olson on Prairie Public weekdays from 9 a.m. to 10 and noon to 6 p.m.
And there's the tune that tells us it's time for our weekly review of the news with Prairie Public's news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, how are you?
I'm doing well, Craig. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Dave. Much going on. We're going to talk about the upcoming primary election in just a moment. But Dave, you've reported now that the U.S. House could soon be voting on its version of a new farm bill, and North Dakota Farmers Union President Mark Watney has weighed in.
He's weighed in. He says there's some pretty good things in there. There's going to be more money to subsidize crop insurance, which he thinks is a pretty good thing in the bill. But one thing that he says could be a deal breaker is that the House wants to cut the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And he says, we're not about that. You need SNAP because urban legislators do not understand the importance of a farm bill without SNAP.
Has our congressional delegation weighed in on this yet, Dave?
Not exactly yet. I don't think they have completely read the bill yet. I'm interested, as he is, to see what the Senate version is going to be. The thinking is the Senate version will be less about cutting SNAP.
Of course, this bill is close to 1,000 pages. There's lots to digest, and it's a $1.5 trillion with a T, Dave?
That's bill? The House bill, yes. That's the House version of it. And that's the first time a farm bill has gone over the trillion-dollar level.
All right, let's move on to talk about an election item. North Dakota voters will be asked if age limits should be set for congressional candidates. Dave, we can talk about that, but I'm asking, doesn't the U.S. Constitution define and regulate the age of congressional members?
Well, yes, it does. You know, I've talked to the people who are sponsoring this, and it's being pushed by Americans for Term Limits. And what they really want to do is use the North Dakota case, at least that's what I'm hearing, use this North Dakota petition to get a case before the U.S. Supreme Court and eventually throw out their earlier ruling that states cannot set their own term limits or any age limits on their members of Congress. And they want the Supreme Court to throw that out. Then they could probably get a state-by-state effort to have term limits, which I think is kind of interesting.
It's hard for me to see how they can be successful with what our Constitution says about the age of congressional members. So we'll follow that along with you, Dave.
Absolutely. It's going to be very interesting to see it. And when you look at the measure says, in very plain language, the state will defend this to its last dollar if need. So.
Ouch, that could be a lot of money coming out of state coffers for the defense of this. Dave, counties are finding election workers now. The June primary is just a few weeks away. What's new there?
Well, what's new is that they're trying to get some of the younger people to do it, but so far there's been a bit of resistance to that. And they said that we've got enough, but we worry about the general election too and whether there's not going to be enough workers. And it's been a little bit of a slog to try to recruit new election workers.
And I think the worry there is that even if North Dakota is successful in covering all of its polling responsibilities now, a lot of these poll workers have been around for a while, and they'll be aging out to retirement here soon.
And as a matter of fact, the head of the North Dakota Association of Counties is actually going to be a poll worker that night.
And that's Executive Director Aaron Burst. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's not ready to retire, but he says, yeah, I'm going to be there working because I really enjoy the process, and you see democracy in action.
And I hope that people who are interested can maybe consider doing this, if not this election season down the road. A fun story, Dave, at Fort Stevenson State Park, a world record with a lot of s'mores.
Lots of s'mores. I can about imagine what that was like. Lots of people. Katie went up and did the story on that and just did a wonderful job. It's a nice to have a story like that to celebrate the Fort Stevenson's 50th anniversary as a state park.
Dave, at the University of North Dakota, the Chester Fritz Auditorium will be renamed to the Chester Fritz Performing Arts Center. What's the significance of that?
Well, the significance is that college students will often think of an auditorium as, oh, it's a lecture hall. Say they want to say, no, it's much more than a lecture hall. It's actually a performance space, and a pretty good performance space it is. Now, when I went to this, when I went to school at UND, it was the performance space in Grand Forks, and I saw, when I moved back to go to work at a commercial radio station in Grand Forks, I saw Harry Chapin live in concert, which was wonderful. I saw the two generations of Brubeck Group, saw Maynard Ferguson there, and a lot of,
Flugelhorn, I've seen a concert with him and thought it was wonderful.
Talented man. That's a great venue, and what got me is I was looking at an agenda of one of the higher education board's committees, and it said, rename Chester Fritz, and I thought, uh-oh, now what? So I clicked on it and said, rename it to the Chester Fritz Performance Center, and I thought, this is too much fun to not do the story on it.
Dave, the BLM rule on coal leasing in the Powder River Basin won't have as much impact here in North Dakota as it did in my native state of Wyoming.
Right, because you've got much more federally owned land in Wyoming, a lot of coal's on federally owned land, also in Montana. Here, not so much in North Dakota. There's a bit, but really a lot of it is owned by companies or owned by private interests.
Dave, oil production, we'll keep on the energy trend here, dropped slightly in March, but it was due to inclement weather. No real concerns there, are there?
No real concerns. And basically what happens is the inclement weather took, this is a little complicated, but the inclement weather took down a natural gas processing plant. It was out of power for a while. And because of their rules concerning flaring of natural gas, it can only flare up to about 5%, or right now it's 9% is the limit. They had to shut in some oil wells. They could not produce oil because they would be having to flare natural gas because they couldn't get it to a processing plant. Once that got back and going, it looks like everything's really on track to get back to the 1.3 million barrels a day.
Dave, there's a study that dives into how legal immigrants can boost North Dakota's workforce, and we've talked about here on this show on Main Street about the Office of Legal Immigration that is now present in Bismarck.
That's right. And the office is really trying to recruit workers to come here because we have an awful lot of jobs that are available in North Dakota, and we just don't have the population to fill all those jobs. So they're looking at things. And remember the effort to get people from Ukraine to come and work in the oil fields, and that worked. And they're talking about, well, maybe illegal immigrants who have come to the United States already may want to look for a job here because we have the jobs here.
In their story, there was a line that said, hey, Chicago and New York, North Dakota could use some of your immigrants.
That's absolutely right. And I think there is going to be some stepped up recruiting, let's put it that way.
And the story that I was reading was in the North Dakota Monitor, and you're reporting it as well. Dave, June 11th is quickly approaching. We talked about that a little bit before. What are you concerned about, or what are you watching right now relative to this primary election that is fast approaching?
Okay, what I'm going to be watching is a couple things. Number one, the governor's race, of course. Who then? That's the governor's race for the Republican nomination. Also, the U.S. House race, which got very interesting after the convention. That's going to be an interesting race to watch. And then I'm looking at some legislative races, the interparty races that Republicans are challenging Republicans for legislative seats. And there is a lot of consternation about that.
Dave, your team will cover the June 11th primary election. Any changes in the way you plan coverage?
To begin with, we're going to be doing a lot of numbers. And then once we find out who the winners are, the job is to go out and get reaction from the winners and those who didn't win. And we'll be working on that. We're probably going to be using newscast times during that Tuesday evening, and we'll stay on the air as long as we need to.
How long has that been in historically, Dave? Have you ever pulled nearly an all-nighter reporting election results?
For the general election, yes. For the primary election, once or twice when they had a couple of very contentious races and a couple of pretty good issues. I do know that when we had Wayne Stengem, who got the nomination at the Republican convention, challenged by Doug Burgum for governor, that took a little while for the returns to get in, so we had a late night that night. So we'll see how it goes.
What other stories are you and your news team working on, Dave?
Now, I was telling people, we had a little donor event in Bismarck, and I was sitting with some people who had graduated from Dickinson State University, so I said, once the primary election is over, I'm going to get toward this, how Dickinson State University lost the Theodore Roosevelt Library to Medora. And I'm not doing it as a criticism story. It's just kind of an interesting story about how things have evolved. Extra. Read all.
about it. Gather round, everybody.
We review the news each week with our news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, I hope you have a nice Memorial Day weekend.
Thank you. Same to you, Craig.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
After the shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, the community rallied behind a phrase to promote strength in the aftermath of tragedy.
On the way over here, I saw the sticker, which I see everywhere, is Uvalde Strong. If that was the case, this room should be filled and then some, showing their support.
Checking in with a small city of 15,000 a couple of years later. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. Central to 9 a.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
And with the fanfare, we now get to look forward to This Week at the Movies with Matt Olie. And Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
Matt, this is a movie that we're going to talk about that reminds me of a series that my wife and I saw and really enjoyed. It was called Step Dave. Step Dave was about this slacker named Dave who was turning his life around and all of a sudden started dating someone 15 years his senior. Mm-hmm. But it was good. It was a good series. And then all of a sudden, here comes the idea of you, which you're going to review today. What do you think of the movie?
Yeah, so this is on Amazon. It's not in theaters that I can tell right now. So I saw it on Amazon if people want to watch this. So Anne Hathaway is the star. And it's not like she's ancient. She's only 41 or 42 years old now and it looks amazing, of course. Wonderful actress. And the essential idea, if you've seen the trailer or know anything about this movie, is she starts dating a 24-year-old man played by Nicholas Galitzine. And he is the member of the boy band August Moon. So that's the plot. I don't want to give too much away because there's some accidents that happen, how they meet through a series of events. It's directed by Michael Showalter. I would call him a reliable director. His best film is The Big Sick with Holly Hunter. He also directed Hello, My Name is Doris, which starred Sally Field. Not as good a movie. Hathaway plays a divorced art gallery owner in Los Angeles. She raises her daughter. Her ex-husband is supposed to take the daughter and her friends to Coachella, and he can't. Last minute issues, that kind of thing. So Anne Hathaway ends up taking them to Coachella so they can meet their idols, the boy band August Moon. One of the members of August Moon is Hayes Campbell, played by Nicholas Galitzine, who's really good in this movie. And through a series of unfortunate, wacky events, and you'll have to watch the movie to find out how this works, Anne Hathaway meets Hayes Campbell, boy band member. Sparks fly. He's attracted to her. She's attracted to him, but doesn't quite see what he sees in her. That is how this May-December romance gets going. I think what works for this film, and look, it's not a great film. It's not going to win awards, but I did like it, Craig, better than I thought I would because romantic comedies.
It was a fun film.
There's a paint-by-numbers approach to romantic comedies, and it's all the same. People meet, et cetera, et cetera. There's conflicts, there's weird things that happen, and everything turns out fine in the end. That's usually how they work. So there's a paint-by-numbers way to go about it, and it kind of follows that but doesn't quite follow it. I would say this film works largely because they have Anne Hathaway. She is a wonderful actress. I've always thought she was. She's an Oscar winner. What she has that a lot of actresses and actors don't have is her emotions are always at the tip of her finger. She can call up emotions in any scene, start crying. It looks believable. It's not forced. Some actors and actresses, Craig, you can see the work. It's very forced acting. It's kind of, you know, you can see the work going into it. She's very natural. She's a natural actor. She's really good. She has a very easy chemistry with Galitzine. You can kind of see this working, even though it is, on the surface, a ridiculous plot that this 40-something art gallery, not because she's not a catch and looks good and she's smart as Anne Hathaway is, but, you know, meeting someone that's famous in a boy band. You know, it sounds like a ridiculous plot, but you just got to go with it. There are many contrived moments that I didn't like that are going to happen without giving plot details away. By contrived, I mean when certain things happen within this plot device, within this narrative structure, it kind of falls into this cardboard character, typical reaction, romantic comedy thing. That happens, and I don't want to get too much into the weeds on that, but there are some contrived moments that almost ruin the film in the third act. But I would say overall, if you're looking for an easy hour, 45 minutes with some laughs and easy chemistry between the stars, there's obviously conflicts that happen once they start dating. You know, her daughter, you know, figures this out, and that creates some issues as well.
Her daughter's a pretty smart little gal, though.
She is smart, yeah, and she's a fan of August Moon, the boy band. So you just got to go with the plot. And sometimes I think with movies, Craig, having an outrageous plot isn't the worst thing in the world. It's because we want that escapism. We want to kind of see what's going on. There's also some somewhat contrived but somewhat poignant points that are made in the film about older women dating younger men and how that's becoming more acceptable. The typical trope, of course, is the older man with the younger woman. But I think they try to hit on those buttons. There's an interesting line in the movie, I'll paraphrase, where Anne Hathaway's friend says, "Everyone hates a happy woman." That's a line that kind of works in the movie. So there's some commentary on how we view dating in America and in the world.
And Anne Hathaway's character struggled with that.
Yes, exactly. There's a ridiculous plot point that I said almost ruins the movie. You can't even believe that this would happen, considering that Anne Hathaway's character is a very good mother who has primary custody, and she does something that's so ridiculous in the movie that she could almost lose custody because of this decision she makes. And so just keep an eye out for those things. I can kind of spot the, you know, those contrivance moments. But overall, I liked it better than I thought I would. It's not going to win awards. But again, Hathaway and Galitzine kind of make this movie.
Matt, here was my beef with the movie, if you will, and it's minor because we enjoyed it too. My wife and I watched it together, and it was kind of a paint-by-numbers romantic comedy. The last third that you talked about was really about a few minutes long. It wasn't long enough. It just ends predictably, maybe, but so quickly they fashioned the ending. I thought they should have maybe developed that out just a little bit more. Just the ending happened too fast for us.
So I see what you're saying there. And again, we don't want to give plot points away here at the ending, because I think people will watch this movie and be excited for the ending. They're going to be excited for how this ends. What's going to happen? Is this going to work out? Is it not going to work out? It's based on a novel by an actress named Robin Lee. And the novel, from my understanding, isn't really that good, and they changed the ending. So the movie changed the ending. This happens a lot when writers sell the rights to their screenplay or their novel. The filmmaker can do what they want. Famously, Stanley Kubrick completely changed The Shining from what Stephen King wanted, but he sold the rights to Stanley Kubrick, and so you get what you get. So the ending is different from the book. I was okay with the ending, but I see what you're saying, Craig. It's a little anticlimactic, hard to stick the landing. One of the hardest things in movies to do is to stick that landing at the end. Casablanca, boy, that stuck the landing, didn't it? There's some movies that stick that ending. I'm not sure if this one stuck the ending or not. I will leave it up to my listeners whether they think it stuck the landing or not. But I see what you're saying. Things move a little quickly at the end. I agree.
What do you have coming up for us, Matt?
Much anticipated Furiosa, a Mad Max saga with Chris Hemsworth and Anya Taylor-Joy. That'll be the next week. And then in 2 weeks, I actually have seen my first Woody Allen movie in 8 years. Coup de Chance, a film he shot in France, French language, subtitled. It's supposedly the best Woody Allen movie in 10 years, which isn't saying much because he's been on a horrible, bad streak here. But we'll talk about Woody Allen's new movie in a couple of weeks as well.
All right, I'm going to ask you two trivia questions today, Matt. First one is easy. In which year did Anne Hathaway win her first Academy Award?
So she won for Les Miserables in 2012, supporting actress.
That's exactly right. Now, what musical number did she perform at the Oscar ceremony in 2009? And you're a sports fan, Matt. You might remember this.
So 2009, which would have been the films that were released
with
in
Hugh
2008.
Jackman.
Yes. Oh, yes. She performed it with Hugh Jackman. Sports fan.
Take me
out to the ball game.
Take me out to the ball game.
Okay.
All right, last question for you, Matt.
Yes.
Timberwolves going to prevail this year? I know you're a big fan.
I think, I'm not a huge NBA fan, but everyone in this area is excited, of course, for the state of Minnesota. I think they're going to beat Dallas, and I think they're going to win the whole thing, but I am a notoriously bad predictor in sports. So I think I may have just jinxed it, but let's hope not.
We have been to the movies with Matt Olean.
Prairie Public is a listener-supported statewide radio network.
We cover everywhere in North Dakota, from the Bakken to Bismarck, Wishick to West Fargo. But we wouldn't be able to bring you NPR News, news from the Prairie region, and all the great cultural and music programs you enjoy without the help of listeners like you. And so, we would like to send a special thank you out to our sustaining members, whose generous monthly contributions keep Prairie Public's radio stations and online streams humming along with quality programs and independent, fact-based journalism. Thank you, sustainers. We simply can't do this without you. Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 23rd. The United States is home to more turtle species than any other country in the world, with almost 100 species and subspecies. North Dakota has 4 native species. All 4 have healthy populations and are classified as least concern on the scale of conservation status. The largest North Dakota turtle is the snapping turtle. They average a length of 12 to 15 inches. They're called snapping turtles for a reason. Their powerful jaws can snap a person's finger. The false map turtle is smaller. The males are usually 3 to 5 inches long, while females reach 8 to 10 inches. They eat both meat and plants. They like stagnant or very slow-moving water. The Midland smooth softshell turtle has a very plain olive drab shell. It gets to be 8 to 13 inches long. These turtles eat plants, but favor meat. They like insects, snails, and small fish. Although they can live in most bodies of water, they prefer water with a muddy or sandy bottom. The 4th North Dakota turtle is the western painted turtle. The shell ranges from dark olive to black, with markings of red, orange, and yellow. They eat both plants and meat. They tend to live in slow-moving rivers, ponds, and lakes. World Turtle Day is held on this date every year. American Tortoise Rescue established World Turtle Day as a yearly observance to help people celebrate and protect turtles and tortoises and their disappearing habitats around the world. The World Turtle Day website offers some tips for helping turtles. If you see a turtle crossing a road, pull over if possible, pick it up, and carry it across. It only takes a minute and can save a turtle from being hit by a car. Always move the turtle in the direction it was going. If you return it to where it came from, it will just turn around and head back. If there is turtle habitat on your property, consult with conservationists on how you can best preserve their home. And do not introduce non-native turtles to the local habitat. They will upset the ecosystem. Happy Turtle Day. It's time to celebrate our turtle friends. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. On today's All Things Considered, the war in Gaza causing division all over the world. Here how some synagogues are working towards compassion. And on The Pulse with Mike and Scott, being gifted means you're smart, right? Well, what happens when being gifted does not feel like a gift?
Ashley, Monday on Main Street, it is, of course, Memorial Day, and we have a special episode that we plan to air. The episode's titled, We've Never Been the Same, a war story. All wars are the same, it's said, only the scenery changes and the repercussions are pretty much the same, too. Over the course of 5 years, Adam Peori gathered the stories of the surviving members of Delta Company, a Vietnam-era paratrooper unit. Jay Allison joined him for the last 2 years when it turned from a book into a captivating radio story, and we'll bring that to you on Monday. We hope you have a great Memorial Day weekend, and we look forward to being with you again after the holidays.